Welcome to series two of Inquire, the Investor Relations podcast. In this series, we will speak with senior investor relations professionals around the world and explore the theme IR out of the ordinary. We will hear and learn more from their experience in dealing with events outside of the usual day-to-day IR activities, such as running an IR program for a dual-listed company, IR through a merger or acquisition, IR during an IPO, managing activism, and IR in a crisis situation. We hope that you enjoy this series as much as you did the first one. Please feel free to share your favorite podcast with any other investor relations professionals. We also welcome all your feedback. And if there's anyone in particular you would like us to speak to, please let us know. In today's interview, we are delighted to be joined by Federico Castillo, Investor Relations Director at the Heineken Company based in Amsterdam. Federico has been in this role for nearly 6 years, and prior to that, he worked in Portugal and Mexico in finance and strategy. Federico studied engineering and technology at MIT and Tecnológica de Monterrey in Mexico. We are truly honored that he found time in his extremely busy schedule to speak with us today, and we hope you enjoy listening to this conversation. So, Federico, I'm very excited to speak with you today. Welcome, and thank you for taking the time to join us. Firstly, tell us where you are.
Well, I'm very happy to be here, Mav, and I am currently located in Amsterdam in the Netherlands. Today, I am working from home.
Okay, fantastic. And you've recently just come out of a really busy period. You just announced your results. How did that go?
Well, it was indeed a very busy period because we announced our results on the 15th of February in the morning. And then over the following 48 hours, we issued another 3 press releases because we also participated in the execution of the largest equity placing, the largest monetization that has happened of securities in Europe since 2004.
Oh my gosh.
We acquired 1 billion of our own shares. What happened is that one of our major shareholders, FEMSA, sold 3.2 billion of shares in an advanced book build and 500 million in an exchangeable bond. So that kept us busy on top of that. So, but the results went very well, and also the placing went very well, and we had a lot of fun at it.
That's fantastic.
If I were to say a couple of things on that, on the results themselves, I think the markets were delighted that we kept our guidance for 2023. Unusually, we had provided a guidance already 6 months ago for this year, which is either incredibly courageous or incredibly foolish, depending on how you look at it. But we kept it, and that was very well received. The recovery of our business post-COVID is also highly appreciated, especially the resilience of Europe, which for us is super important. In the fourth quarter, we had good results there, and that was very much welcome. At the same time, there's always points of concern. And still, the consumer environment in Europe is a big question mark of how it will play out as inflationary pressures carry their toll. But also, in our case, the volatility of our results between the first half and the second half create a bit of discomfort. Investors like boring and predictable, but clear. So this kind of volatility, it's a bit frowned upon or disliked or a source of a concern. But hey, the times we live in are very volatile. But I would say those are some of the elements of precisely what was interesting about our results.
Yeah, certainly. I think in a volatile environment, IR becomes even more important in how we guide the market and ensure that investors and analysts understand the levers that the business can pull and the factors that influence that volatility in your environment. So I certainly think communicating more rather than less is helpful to reassure the market. What do you think about that?
Absolutely. That is exactly what you need to do. I remember when COVID hit March 2020, the number of calls I was having with investors basically doubled or tripled versus a regular period. And we were issuing one press release after another about our actions. I think that over a period of 3 weeks, we issued two or four press releases thereabouts. Some of them were about some of the donations and how we were taking care of the communities where we operate to the extent that we could. Yes. But also, we pulled our guidance and speaking about what we could. And those moments are critical that IR really needs to be out there speaking to investors who also want to get a bit of a sense of what is happening.
Yeah. Speaking of speaking to investors, now that we're back out in the world, we're seeing the return of the Capital Markets Day. And actually, we recently published a paper on that where we spoke about, well, what's the point? What's the purpose? What does it look like? What does a good Capital Markets Day look like? What's the sort of information that one would share at a Capital Markets Day? And I think you recently had one in December, is that right? How did you approach that? What was your thinking behind what's the purpose of the day? What do we want our investors and analysts to get out of it? How did you approach that? And how do you know if it was a success?
All very good questions, but probably I need to take two steps back in order to answer that properly. Because without that context, you wouldn't appreciate fully why we did it and why that was the right timing and why that was the right content. In addition to COVID, we had a CEO transition right in the midst of it. So our new CEO had day one being the 1st of June of 2020.
Right.
So taking the helms of this company after the previous CEO had been in place for 15 years. So he comes in the midst of this crisis and a bit with the philosophy of never waste a good one and let's drive significant change.
Yeah.
But at the same time, he was at that very moment very keen that we needed to navigate the crisis first before you started to shape the future. So the first thing we did was launch the new strategy under the banner of Evergreen. You know, we're Heineken, so we have something for the color green. And Evergreen, as a nature, the trees in nature that are in constant renewal, embodied exactly what we're trying to do, which is about a slow adaptation, resiliency, nature that are important for companies. So we launched that and presented to the financial markets in February of 2021. So this, we did our Capital Markets Day pretty much 2 years after the new strategy was introduced, or 2 years and a half after the new CEO had taken helm.
Wow, okay.
So since then, he had set up a new team, he had launched a new strategy, and it was the right time for now his team to come to the markets and explain what is it that we're doing. Having now the sensation that the crisis of COVID was a bit behind us, but all of these good things that we have been building all throughout to shape the future, what were they all about? So it's very important that you shouldn't do a Capital Markets Day just because it's again November or March or whatever is your date, and now you have to fill the calendar. It has to be a very clear milestone for management and for the connection of the equity story towards investors.
Yeah.
So we launched the strategy, and this was the first ever show me some proof points of where you are and that this is working. And that's what it was all about.
That sounds great. And I'm assuming it was very well received and very thoroughly presented. I think there were quite a few slides involved in all of it.
We had a few hundred of those. It was, we were squeezed between Nestlé, who had their own Capital Markets Day in Barcelona at the beginning of the week, then us at the end of the week in Amsterdam, And then the week after, Unilever in London. And I had investors that attended the three of them.
Wow, yes.
And the feedback that I received was, I won't be very explicit about it, but made us very happy.
That's fantastic. And your role in pulling this all together, are you sort of at the center of all of it, speaking to all the management team and getting the information together? Do you have people working with you? How did you, the practical side of approaching this, how did you go about it?
We did it in the following way, very purposely. So actually, before how we executed it, first is the role of mobilizing the organization to do this and getting our CEO and our CFO to say, yes, we're going to do this. We're going to do this on this date. Yes, you can ask people to save the date. The moment that I issued the save the date, they were on the hook.
Yeah.
Because management will always find a good reason to do this just a little bit later. So my first advice to my colleagues of IRs is find a lock, put them in a corner, and have them commit to a date. That's the first thing. Now, the second is then the way to go about it. We had a choice of, we had the entire executive team present. So those were 10 presentations. And you really want to have a common thread across them.
Exactly.
So we came to realize very quickly, maybe in other companies, it could work differently. At Heineken, we have a very decentralized entrepreneurial culture, which we love, we cherish, is part of what drives us. But that can, having the risk that everybody does their own thing.
Exactly.
And we did not want that. So it was very important that the look and feel, the messaging, the consistency, the interconnection between the 10 presentations was there, was visible. And it was something you could feel and see.
Yeah.
The only way to then go about it is that you keep the pen centralized. But that is a massive burden for the IR team because we're not equipped to do that on a regular basis.
Uh-huh.
We are equipped to, you know, put together a few slides for an event, for a presentation at the half year, the full year. Half of your slides are standard. So,
yes.
But then to come up with 200 slides that are ad hoc, it's for a capital markets day, it's something completely different. But then depends on the skills that you have in your team. And what Chloe also said is, well, we need an expanded team. So we invited some colleagues from the strategy team to join us,
mm-hmm.
and some colleagues from the CEO office to join us, the CEO staff, for example. And together, we basically did all the presentations.
Sounds like you pulled a few rabbits out the hat, for sure.
Say that a few times.
And Tommy, this is interesting what you said about the culture at Heineken. Is there a connection between that and the shareholding structure? Is there any link between those two things? And maybe you can just give us a little bit of a sense of the shareholding structure and how that works, because that's quite different to certainly the typical listed company environments where I've worked in.
Well, two things. Yes, the entrepreneurial culture comes very much from the family because it was a startup at some point. The family then, back almost 100 years ago, then sold the business and bought it back when they said, oh no, my God, what did we do? Probably the most symbolic moment was that when a prohibition was lifted in the US, it was the Heineken family that was there on the moment with the first shipment of Heineken beers being unloaded off the boat to go into the market.
Yes.
So there's always been this drive from the Dutch to be sent to this remote place and really start a business from scratch. And that's how places like in the DRC in Africa, you would have had our first brewery several decades ago. It's about resilience, it's about entrepreneurship, but also about independence, because, you know, 60 years ago, if you went to the DRC, you didn't have very strong communications and a lot of frameworks from head office telling you what exactly you needed to do, right? So that's how Heineken is built. You can find today the Heineken brand everywhere out of precisely that growth in scope and in countries that came from that period, then it's very much into what we do. The Heineken brand is present in almost twice as many other countries than the second biggest, most widespread global brand.
Yeah.
It's ubiquitous in some extent. That was driven by the family, and the family was really managing the business with all the caveats that come with a family-run business up to the 80s thereabouts. And it's only then that Heineken began to change from a family-run business to a family-owned business. And that's what the structure is. The structure is simply, you know, some companies have A shares, B shares for the controlling shareholder versus the rest of the shareholders. Heineken has a dual structure where the family sits in the holding, and then the holding, which is listed, by the way, also basically carries the custodianship of the long-term vision of the Heineken strategy. Makes life in the company, I think, very nice because it is a great balance of you are a listed company. You are under the scrutiny of the financial markets of investors. But at the same time, we don't yield to the whims of quarterly demands of the financial markets, which can be prickly, is probably the word.
Yes. I remember when quarterly reporting first came out and felt incredibly frustrated by that because management, the company needs time to run the business. And I felt like we were constantly running from one announcement to the next. And actually found that quite a distraction rather than helpful. And this might sound like it's contradicting what I said earlier, that in tough times, we need to communicate more. But those are uncertain or tough times are very different from quarterly reporting, in my opinion. We report more when we feel that there's a need to or a demand or a desire from the market. And I actually think also with quarterly reporting, the feedback certainly we got from analysts and investors that it became distracting for them too. Investors became more short-term and analysts were forced to write more research that wasn't really adding a lot of value. So I'm applauding you on the fact that you focus on what's important and when to announce that. And that's definitely a positive consequence of your shareholding structure. So it sounds like what you've said from the family ownership, actually, it's nice. It's an opportunity to work in a different way. Are there any challenges that might be a little bit different working in that environment? Or is it generally just a more positive?
Oh, I mean, as a company, we have a lot of challenges, right? But I don't think that they're related to the structure of the ownership. And having said that, like any other business, especially a global corporation that is has operating companies across 80 countries, you name it, the challenges that we have left or right are as wide as politics around the globe. So
how do you stay on top of everything?
Well, you have to be on the ball and you have to be close to the decision makers and to the operations. I have the privilege that from the start, my CFO told me, listen, you need to understand that, and the organization understands that you have access to everybody. So you don't need to go through a regional structure or a functional structure to go to an operation to try to find out what happened on a particular case. Just pick up the phone and call the person involved and get what is needed. So, for example, in preparation for a full year results or half year results release, I would have a half an hour call with the CEOs of our top 20 operating companies. And I discuss with them what are the latest things, not about the results, you know, what is happening in the market, what is the story, how should we position things externally. They know that in our press release, there will be a paragraph on their company. Mm-hmm. And that will have cons. So we align a little bit some of the key messages that we would like to convey during those calls. I read a lot. I receive all kinds of Bloomberg alerts and whatnot. And you have to stay on pretty much on top of that. You become a fast reader. I receive around 200, 300 emails a day, and you're able to filter pretty quickly what's important, what's not important, to then be on top of, right? For example, COVID was such a big time for us. But when I explained to my CFO, listen, I'm getting calls every 30 minutes from investors wanting to know what is happening. Everything was moving so fast that it's impossible. They've been trying to follow what was happening. So I said, well, so they basically put me inside the crisis committee, the central crisis committee. So basically, that group was having daily me sessions discussing everything that was happening and what was coming about. So I had a front seat to what was happening. And then I was using my best judgment as to how to be shaping the external narrative.
Yeah.
So that's a little bit some of the things that I do.
Yeah, I think also from my own experience and from, you know, speaking to fellow IR people, having a seat at the top table makes you, us IR people, so much more valuable and effective in what we do. And what you just said there, you know, using our judgment of the information that needs to find its way or how that information is disclosed to the market, you know, that's where we become more valuable. The more context we have, the more information we have, the more access we have, the more valuable we become in our role. So I absolutely agree with that. I wanted to just take a slide.
I have just another element of process, because we grow wiser as we go in the role. Something I didn't do at the beginning, and I do now every time, is at the very beginning of the whole process, even before I go speak to the 20 operating companies ahead of a full year results press release, the very first session that I have is with my CEO and my CFO. And we discuss, what is the message house? What are the key things? What are the key challenges? What are the questions we need to figure out between now and communication day? What are the hot topics? And what would we like to say if we had to announce them today?
Yeah.
And have the discussion so that then, as you go about preparing your communications, you're basically closing the questions that were open at that moment, at the start, and you are then fully aligned with management at the end.
How do you link in with the other communications, branding, marketing teams around moments of big announcements, whether it's, you know, unveiling Evergreen strategy or your Capital Markets Day or Results Day or your recent transaction? How do you get everybody together, or do you?
Well, I don't get them together. The same way that I do those calls with the 20 CEOs of our operating companies, I also have meetings with the head of procurement, the head of digital, the head of the Heineken brand, the head of international brands, the head of our innovation department. You know, so all the people that, in why we're one way or another, are contributing, our head of sustainability, for example. So all the people that have big inputs into our equity story, and I'm basically updating a narrative of how we're speaking about the success and the highlights, right? So with the Heineken brand team, so what are the key successes and milestones that the Heineken brand achieved this year and that we want to showcase? We've been speaking about this in the strategy. What kind of proof points can I bring to the table? And then they're not thinking like that. They're not thinking, oh, this is what we have said externally. We would like to show a proof point on that. When I ask that question, they can very easily say, oh, we've done this, we've done that. And they say, oh, out of those three, I like this one. That works very, that could work best. That's how we go. So it's a very orderly process that we have to get that in place. That's, let's say, building up towards results. Then if there's specific ad hoc things, then they come in two flavors. We're a company that is expanding a lot inorganically. So we do a lot of M&A. So we have a monthly meeting with our M&A team, which is basically just updating us. Listen, these are the 15 or 20 things that we're looking at, from tiny to bigger. And this is how they are going a little bit at pace. And some things start to gather steam, and that has a special life of its own. We are involved on everything that is happening, aware of everything that is happening.
Yeah.
Because some of those may have communication needs. Some of them could potentially be price sensitive from a market abuse regulation perspective, that you are the expert to some extent bringing that perspective into the table. And we don't do it only for IR. Those dynamics, we involve accounting, tax, legal, communications. And we discuss those projects so that the M&A teams are aware of unexpected implications on other part of the business that they've been be less in touch of.
Right.
That's how we go about it.
Okay. A slightly different angle for a question. I'm so curious about your path to investor relations. I know that you studied, and I just need to remind myself.
Physics.
Yes. And then ended up in IR. I'm just trying to understand that transition. Yeah. How did that come about?
Well, I've always been a very curious person. I like a lot of analytics. I also like to talk to people, and I like, not necessarily the most introvert. So I think all of that helped. I studied physics, and I studied then a master's in technology policy at MIT. And after that, I went into McKinsey. I was in management consulting for almost 6 years. And then I joined the beer business, completely a side turn, but one thing led to another. And then when the opportunity of IR came about, it was, you have background on management consulting, so you know about strategy, you know about the external perspective of businesses, you have been in the company already operating in the operations in Mexico, in Amsterdam, in Portugal, so you have a breadth of experience there. And it was also the timing, because at that moment, the company wanted somebody from the business to come and talk about the business. And because we had, at that moment in time, pretty good processes from an IR perspective, in terms of the systems, the context, you know, the strategic identification of the targeting of our prospects, and all of those things were very much in place and operated very well. So it was more about bringing a bit of depth of what the industry is doing and what we are doing in our conversations with investors.
Right. And as you say, you're an extrovert and you like to talk. So it's actually the perfect combination of skills that you bring to the table, because you've been in this role now for, what, about 6 years?
That is correct. Mm-hmm. That is correct. And enjoying it very much.
That's fantastic. I love that story. And in the 6 years, any particular moment that you can think of that either was extremely challenging or maybe just unexpected that you can share with our audience?
I would say two in particular. The first one was when we took the decision to exit Russia. I had the opportunity to be part of the group that was involved in the process and in the decision. Our CEO was very open, very kind, and he did at the end a round of asking everybody that was in that meeting what their view was of what the course of action should be. It was so nice, so unanimous, and the way we went about it was asking ourselves the question, these are values. What is the best course of action? Which is the only way in which whatever outcome you're going to get to is going to be the best decision. Mm-hmm. When you're faced with what feels at some moment a reconcilable dilemma between staying and 1,800 employees that are part of our team that we need to take care of. And how do you balance that? So that was one. So be principle-based at the toughest moments.
Yeah.
The second one, which is about courage, which happened actually last week. And we published our results And then the day after, we go on roadshow, like most companies do. And as I mentioned, this big transaction happened where FEMSA did the placement, and we bought back 1 billion of our own shares. And we knew that FEMSA was going to do this because they announced it the evening before. We didn't know exactly when it would happen. But then here I am 15 minutes before the sell side meeting with my CEO and my CFO, and I receive a call from general counsel saying, this will happen within the next hour. You need to cancel that meeting. And I tell them, hold on. I have the 25 sales. We have 25 sales side analysts, but there were 25 people in the room, but probably only about 18 of the banks.
Yeah.
They're there. Where the CEO and the CFO are getting mic'd. I'm not going to cancel. So what are the rules of engagement in the situation? What are the do's? What are the don'ts? What I'm telling you is you need to cancel. I say, well, but we're not going to cancel. So how do we go about it? So we went like that for a few minutes and said, Federico, in the end, I cannot advise you any differently than to cancel the meeting. And of course, he said, if there's also external counsel you want to talk to. So in the end, I did. In the end, came to our CEO and CFO. Well, this is the advice that I have from general counsel, but my recommendation is that we go ahead, and if this really happens, then we take pause, and I will explain that they have to respect us because we cannot speak to the event. So that's what we did. And it happened, and we had to suspend the meeting. And then I told them, upon the advice of general counsel, we cannot say anything. So we could have canceled this. And out of respect for you guys, we didn't. So please respect us in return. Going to your CEO and CFO in the moment and overriding the advice of general counsel for the sake of your stakeholders, which are, in this case, the investors or the sell-side analysts,
yes,
takes courage. So there can be moments of that. To me, it happened just last week. So I thought that that's the one that came top of my mind.
Well, thank you for sharing that, because I think many of us have been or will find ourselves in that situation where you have to make that judgment call. So, Federico, I've loved speaking to you. I have one more question for you. And this has nothing to do with investor relations. What is your favorite beer? Of all, the beers that you have, I need to know, what is your favorite one?
If you're in the beer industry, you would know that that's an impossible question to answer. Because the right question is, what is your college beer? What is your home alone beer, and what is the beer when you're at a party?
Okay. All right. So
my college beer is Tecate. Uh-huh. It's a brand that I drank for many years and probably a bit too much at times back in the day.
Right.
If I'm out there in a party, I would drink Heineken. It's just, I think it's the embodiment of togetherness for me.
Yes.
If I'm at home at dinner, then I would like either a Lagunitas or a Brandt IPA.
Okay.
That's my thing.
Well, thank you for those recommendations. I'm sure we're going to see the sales soar of those particular beers. And Federico, thanks again for your time. I really enjoyed speaking to you and wishing you and the company the very best with your Evergreen. I love the name, Evergreen Strategy. I think that's fantastic. So well done. And thank you for your time.
Thank you, Mav. And I was very happy to be here and to share some of this with some of my IR colleagues around the world.
All right. Thank you.
And thank you for joining Enquire, the Investor Relations podcast. Please look out for our next episode in conversation with senior investor relations professionals in the UK.